Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. Friends, I again implore you to comply with social distancing. Whether you have been officially ordered to or not, it's up to us to protect the most vulnerable during the COVID-19 crisis. Most little girls dream of having a baby. Our first toy is often a baby doll. The first dolls date back to the ancient civilizations of Egypt, Greece, and Rome. We are conditioned from an early age to want to be mothers, to be nurturers. Not all of us, of course. The percentage of childless women who are in the peak of their childbearing years range from 54% in our late 20s to 34% in our early 30s. By age 35, if you want to have a child, your doctor will categorize you as a geriatric pregnancy. This is for many reasons, among them infertility and women choosing to have children later in life. We are no longer expected to get married and have a baby as soon as we are adults. Infertility is the most heartbreaking of these statistics. About 10% of women in the U.S. are infertile. In extremely rare cases, some women become so fixated on becoming a mother that they are willing to do the unthinkable. It's not always about the baby either. Sometimes they enjoy the attention of pregnancy and new motherhood. Sometimes they are trying to save a failing relationship, to bind a man to them with a child they can't actually have. So they will fake a pregnancy, but as their fictional due date gets closer, they get more and more desperate. Welcome to episode 90, Fetal Abduction and the Murder of Bobby Jo Stinnett. Yvonne Wood wrote, "There are no such thing as curses, only people and their decisions." I think the tiny town of Skidmore, Missouri might disagree. It is most famous for the life and death of the town bully, Ken Rex McElroy. An estimated 50 witnesses watched as McElroy was executed in broad daylight after he had terrorized the town for 2 decades. No one was ever charged in his murder, because every witness insisted they didn't see anything. People say that this vigilante justice put a dark cloud over Skidmore, a curse that would come home to root some 20 years after McElroy's murder. In the course of 3 years, there would be 1 disappearance and 2 brutal murders in a town with less than 400 residents. Today, Skidmore has less than 250 residents. Skidmore is located in Nottoway County in northwestern Missouri. You don't typically think of it as a southern state, but technically it can be categorized as Midwestern and Southern. During the Civil War, Missouri was claimed by the Union and Confederacy. There were 2 competing state governments. At the beginning of the war, Missouri's governor, Claiborne Fox Jackson, was a Southern sympathizer who favored secession. It was an unpopular stance for the state as a whole. Most people did not want to secede from the Union, but they also didn't support the war on the Confederacy. I've known this bit of Civil War history, but hadn't thought of it much until recently. I watched the documentary No One Saw a Thing about the murder of Ken Rex McElroy and the effect it had on Skidmore. and I have considered covering the McElroy case before, but I know it's been covered by several podcasts, an award-winning book, a movie, and now this documentary. But fun fact, my husband and I lent our Southern accents to the podcast Minds of Madness when they covered McElroy over 2 years ago. After watching that new documentary and hearing so many Southern accents, I decided that instead of covering McElroy myself, I would cover another case from Skidmore. And I've never done anything like this one before. Before we get into the murder of Bobbie Jo Stinnett and the fetal abduction of her daughter, I do want to discuss the other two cases that have made the town of Skidmore feel as though they are cursed. And ironically, these two other cases are related to Bobbie Jo by marriage. The first is Wendy Gillenwater. She was Joanne Stinnett's granddaughter. Joanne is Bobbie Jo Stinnett's step-grandmother-in-law. That might seem like a tenuous connection, but in a town as small as Skidmore, it's not. Joanne was as close to her stepchildren and step-grandchildren as she was her own kids. Her 25-year-old granddaughter Wendy and her boyfriend, Gregory Dragoo, were meth addicts. By the year 2000, meth had become a huge problem for the small town of Skidmore. Locals recall many meth house explosions, and most of the crime at that time centered around the highly addictive drug. Greg Dragoo was extremely controlling and abusive to Wendy, isolating her from her family. On the night of October 16, 2000, Greg Dragoo, in a methamphetamine rage, started hitting and kicking Wendy. She fell to the floor and did not fight back. He then carried her outside and threw her on the ground. She wasn't moving, and he continued to punch and kick her. A neighbor heard the noise, walked outside, and saw what was happening and called 911. Gregory Dragoo was sitting on his front porch steps at 406 East Elm Street when police and ambulance arrived. News reports said he stomped her to death. An autopsy would show she had 6 fractured ribs on her right side and 8 on her left side, and her liver was lacerated. Her official cause of death was blunt force trauma to her chest and abdominal injuries. She also had 2 black eyes, cuts and hemorrhages all over her scalp and her swollen face and neck. She was unrecognizable. Her mother had to identify her body by the rings on her fingers. Dragoo admitted the assault right away. He also said when he carried her outside, he thought she was already dead. Joanne Stinnett was alerted by a neighbor as Wendy was still in the ambulance. But when she reached St. Francis Hospital in Maryville, she learned her granddaughter was already dead. Wendy was laid to rest on October 20th at the Hillcrest Cemetery in Skidmore. In August of 2001, Gregory Dragoo waived his right to a jury trial and pled guilty to second-degree murder. He was given the maximum sentence for that charge, life imprisonment. The next tragedy to strike the Stinnett family was the disappearance of Branson Perry in April of 2001. He was Joanne's grandson. He was the son of Bob and Becky Perry. Bob Perry was Joanne Stinnett's son from her first marriage. She married 3 times and had a total of 9 children, including her stepchildren, to whom she remained close. Branson Perry was born February of 1981, the same year that Kenrex McElroy was murdered. He was 20 years old and already involved in drugs. He was blonde-haired, blue-eyed, with big ears that made him look much younger than he was. He had told his father about an incident that happened to him a few days before he disappeared. Branson had gone over to his neighbor's house, Jason Bierman. According to Branson, Bierman spiked his drink. While on this hallucinogenic drug, Branson shaved his pubic hair, danced naked around the house, and had sex with Bierman. His father Bob was angry because he felt Bierman drugged and used his son. But he also knew Branson did drugs and had slept with other men. He later admitted his son was homosexual. Branson was ashamed and knew what kind of humiliation he would suffer if this experience was made public. There weren't many, if any, openly gay men in Skidmore, a small town with less than 350 people. On April 11th, Bob had been in the hospital but was about to be released, so Branson enlisted his friend Gina to help clean up the house for his return. He walked outside at one point, and Gina saw him talking to two guys who were replacing the alternator in Bob's car. She said she yelled out the window, "Branson, what are you doing?" He answered, quote, "I'm going to put away the jumper cables, and then I'm going to run out for a bit. I'll be back in a few minutes." He was never seen again. Joanne Stinnett went to visit her son Bob in the hospital the next day and asked if Branson had been there the night before. He had not, even though he had been visiting his dad every night. Joanne drove back to Skidmore to the Perry home on Oak Street, just a block south of Elm, where her granddaughter had been murdered. The house was empty. She tried not to be too alarmed, but she called the house repeatedly over the next few days. Bob stayed in the hospital longer than expected. Branson's mom, Becky, hadn't seen him either. She was now divorced from Bob, so they didn't live together, and Branson lived with his dad. On April 16th, Joanne, Becky, and Bob Perry filed a missing persons report. His dad thought Branson was still distressed over the incident with Jason Bierman and wanted to duck out of town. He didn't have a car, so he thought he might have hitchhiked. In April of 2003, the FBI was investigating a child pornography ring on the internet and came across a man named Jack Wayne Rogers. He was a Presbyterian minister and Boy Scouts leader who lived in Fulton, Missouri, about 3.5 hours away from Skidmore. They discovered his real name after filing a court order to America Online to obtain his identity. He went by the screen name Burger Butt, and he had many conversations and chat rooms with other pedophiles. He had described a disturbing scene with a blonde boy from Skidmore he claimed he had picked up hitchhiking. He kept calling him it in this horrific chat. I won't go into all the details because it's extremely graphic and upsetting, and it may not even be true. Jack Wayne Rogers was convicted of owning child pornography, obscenity charges, first-degree assault, and practicing medicine without a license. But he was not charged in connection with Branson's disappearance. That last charge is because he performed a gender reassignment surgery at a hotel in Columbia, Missouri. Rogers had his own disgusting reasons for performing this surgery that I also won't go into. The victim was desperate and could not afford the real surgery. She nearly bled to death before she went to an ER a few days later. After the internet chat was discovered, Rogers denied knowing anything about Branson Perry, even after he was sentenced to 30 years in prison, and Branson's mother begged him just to tell her where Branson's body was. He remains the only real suspect in Branson Perry's disappearance. If you want to learn more about Jack Wayne Rogers, I suggest Diane Fanning's book, Baby Be Mine. She devotes a chapter to Branson's disappearance and goes into the graphic details found on Rogers' computer. Rogers is still incarcerated in a federal prison in Fort Worth, Texas. He is 75 years old and still has 9 years to serve. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break.
Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals, and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
On December 16th, 2004, 23-year-old Bobby Joe Stinnett had set up a meeting with a woman named Darlene she had met over the internet. Bobby Joe bred rat terriers, and she ran her business online, calling it Happy Haven Rat Terriers. A woman named Darlene Fisher contacted Bobby Joe on December 15th because she wanted to come look at Bobby Joe's new litter of rat terriers. They agreed to meet the next morning at Bobby Joe's house. She lived at 410 Elm Street, about four houses down from where Wendy had been murdered. Bobby Joe was very popular and respected in the online community of rat terrier breeders. They had a chat room called Ratter Chatter, where she often gave advice. And she met people in the community all the time. She was not worried about this woman coming to her home. Bobby Joe was born in Maryville, Missouri on December 4th, 1981. Also the same year Kenrex McElroy was murdered in the streets of Skidmore. Her parents were Becky and Joseph Potter. Becky and Joseph, known as Buck, had married in 1978. Becky had suffered one miscarriage before she became pregnant with her dream baby, Bobby Joe. Buck wasn't much of a husband. He had no real interest in working and supporting his wife, much less his newborn daughter. He eventually deserted Becky and Bobby Joe, moving to Texas. Their divorce was final in 1985. Becky remarried, and when Bobby Joe was 13, her half-brother Tyler was born. Becky Harper worked hard in Skidmore, especially after Buck left. She worked at the B&B market in town to support her little girl. Bobby Joe was born with a cleft palate. She had corrective surgery at 2 years old, as well as tubes put in her ears after many painful ear infections. Despite the repair, Bobby Joe had a slight speech impediment when she was little, causing her to be shy and speak slowly as she grew older. She went to Nottoway Holt High School in Graham, Missouri, where she joined 4-H and became a cheerleader, overcoming her childhood shyness. She worked on the school newspaper and yearbook and was very popular. She was an honor student who loved to ride horses. She graduated in the year 2000. While still in high school, Bobby Joe got into a serious relationship with a childhood friend named Zeb Stinnett. Zeb Stinnett was Joanne Stinnett's step-grandson. She was married to his grandfather, A.B. Stinnett. Zeb's father was Danny Stinnett. Joanne was very close to her step-grandson, and they lived nearby. After graduation, Bobby Joe got a job at a feed and supply store just off the state highway. And Zeb got a job at the Kawasaki Motor Plant in Maryville, Missouri. Even at her first job, she talked about her dream of breeding rat terriers and making it a business. Her first dog, named Tipsy, had a litter in January of 2002, and Bobby Joe's home business began. She and Zeb married on April 26, 2003, and she quit the feed and supply store for a better-paying position at the Kawasaki plant with her husband. By 2004, Bobby was a popular and respected breeder within the rat terrier community, and she often went to dog shows. Many people spoke of her natural ease with dogs, one friend telling author Diane Fanning that dogs just melted in her presence. They seemed to bond with her almost immediately. She was a natural. Her business was going great, and that spring, she found out she was pregnant. Her due date was January 16th, and in November, she and Zeb found out they were having a baby girl. Bobby Joe planned to name her child Victoria Joe. Photographs of Bobby Joe show a glowing, beautiful mother-to-be. She had light brown hair and large brown eyes. One photo, taken November 14th at a dog show in Oklahoma, shows her with a cute baby bump, leading a dog. She was that kind of perfect, beautiful pregnant woman with no other weight except her bump. At around 12:30 p.m. on December 16th, Bobby Joe opened her door to the woman she knew as Darlene. She and Darlene took the puppies outside and played with them for a while. The last relative to speak to Bobby Joe was her mother, Becky. She called at 2:30 to make sure that her daughter could still give her a ride home from work at 3:30. Bobby Joe promised she would, and they hung up. At 3:30, when Bobby Joe didn't show up, Becky started calling her house but got no answer. She only worked about two blocks from where Bobby Joe and Zeb lived, so she walked over there. She saw the front door was open and called out to her daughter, but got no answer. She went in and found Bobby Joe lying in a pool of blood in the dining room. She called 911 at 3:38 p.m. This next part is gruesome, so skip ahead if it will trouble you. Becky saw that her daughter was covered in blood. Her belly was splayed open, revealing her internal organs. Even the soles of Bobby Joe's feet were covered in blood. On the call to 911, Becky was almost incoherent and still couldn't believe what she was seeing. She told the operator, quote, "My daughter's intestines exploded." The 911 operator asked if Bobby Joe was still breathing, and Becky said, "I don't know," but immediately dropped to the floor, following the operator's instructions for CPR. The closest first responder was Nottoway County Sheriff Ben Espy, and he was in Maryville when he got the call. He made the half-hour drive to Skidmore in 14 minutes, and Becky was still giving CPR to her daughter, crying to the sheriff that she needed help. The sheriff and Becky worked together until the ambulance got there 5 minutes later. Skidmore, a town without so much as a fast food restaurant, was a half-hour away from emergency services. The EMTs took over CPR but quickly realized it was too late. Bobby Joe was dead. The sheriff told them that she was 8 months pregnant, and the EMT pointed out the cut umbilical cord. He said, quote, "This lady has been murdered because someone came to get that child out of her body." Even though she was dead at the scene, the EMTs rushed her to the hospital anyway, where she was formally pronounced dead. At the hospital, it was found that there were two ligature marks on Bobby Joe's throat. She had been strangled from behind. They also noticed that the incision on Bobby Joe's abdomen was jagged. Sheriff Espy worked quickly. He knew that his department would need help and needed it fast. He called in the FBI to assist as he looked over the scene. Bobby Joe had suffered greatly and had put up a hell of a fight. The struggle began in the bedroom, and there were blood clots everywhere. Bobby Joe had initially been strangled, but as her attacker cut into her belly, she awoke and stood up, trying to fight for her life. The blood on her feet proved that. And her body was found in the dining room. She had blonde hairs clutched in her hands, and she did not have blonde hair. Hers was brown. She had fought desperately for her life. Police found no forced entry into the home, and one of Bobby Joe's neighbors reported seeing a dirty pinkish-red two-door vehicle in Bobby Joe's driveway from around 12:30 p.m. to when he left his house at 2:30 p.m. Police immediately began searching for the car, which they thought was a Honda. But Nottoway County borders Iowa, Kansas, and Nebraska. That's a huge search area. And naturally, Zeb Stinnett's alibi was checked just in case this was a domestic violence incident. But he had never left his job at Kawasaki Motors that day. Just an hour and a half after he found Bobby Joe, Sheriff Espy called the state headquarters for the Amber Alert system in Jefferson City. They needed to know hair and eye color, skin complexion, and the size and weight of the abducted baby. Espy could not provide any of these answers, so his request was denied. Espy had already spoken with the medical staff at St. Francis, who told him that the baby could still be alive, but it would need treatment right away as it was premature. Aside from a possible lack of oxygen, there was no way to know what other injuries the baby had suffered. Espy was determined to find a way to get Bobby Joe's baby on the Amber Alert system. He called U.S. State Representative Sam Graves at his home, hoping he could help get through the red tape. The congressman for his district also happened to be the brother of the United States Attorney Todd Graves in Kansas City. Espy also called in the Missouri State Highway Patrol, and they called the St. Joseph's Police Department, the next largest city in Missouri. It was all hands on deck, as police from every jurisdiction searched dumpsters, trash on the side of the road, they looked in streams, searched creek beds and riverbanks, all the while looking out for the car Bobby Joe's neighbor had described. The first St. Joseph detective to enter the Stinnett home oversaw the team of crime scene technicians and then went to look at the computer he saw in the kitchen. He called in a forensic computer specialist named Curtis Howard right away. Howard brought his own equipment, and then he took the Stinnett computer out of the crowded house to a command post parked on the street. He knew that he needed to image the hard drive to find everything, but that could take up to 6 hours. He decided to boot up the computer and see what he could find for himself quickly. it didn't take him long to find a chat room, where he found a conversation Bobby Joe had with a woman from Fairfax, Missouri, who was supposed to meet her that day. The email address was fisher4kids@hotmail.com. He quickly found that the woman identified herself as Darlene Fisher. Police immediately sent officers to Fairfax, less than a half hour from Skidmore, and they searched official records for any Darlene Fisher in the area. They found none. Every passing minute was excruciating for Sheriff Espy and the rest of the huge force of officers involved. They were determined to find this baby. At 12:30 a.m. on the 17th, they finally got their Amber Alert, and it went coast to coast. Congressman Graves had pulled every string he could and overcame the bureaucratic red tape. The call went out telling people to report any abandoned or discarded bloody clothing or towels. They warned that it was a small infant and could have health issues and would have a very recently cut umbilical cord. An anonymous tip came from the Amber Alert, pointing investigators to a small town in Kansas. Not long after that tip, in the early morning of the 17th, investigators found the IP address for the Fisher's 4Kids email. It was accessed via dial-up internet. Investigators obtained the phone number linked to the account and then searched the number and found it was assigned to Kevin Montgomery in Malvern, Kansas. The anonymous tip had been correct. Sheriff Espy found the best interrogator he knew, a man named Randy Strong with the Maryville Public Safety. He ordered him to drive from Maryville to Malvern. He told Strong, "Don't stop for anybody. You just go in the house and don't let anyone get in your way." Strong and another officer drove 125 miles an hour. It was normally a 2.5 hour drive. They made it in an hour and 20 minutes. When they got to the Montgomery house, they saw a red car in the driveway that had matched the neighbor's description. Kevin Montgomery answered their knock on the door. Randy Strong pushed his way into the house immediately and saw Lisa Montgomery, Kevin's wife, on the couch with a small infant in her arms. He said, "Is that your new baby?" And she said, "Yes, you want to see it?" And then she handed the baby over to the officer. He noticed fresh cut marks on Lisa's hands right away. Authorities already had all the necessary warrants they needed, so Randy Strong walked right out the door with the baby in his arms. He called Sheriff Espy and said, "I have the baby in my hands." It had been 23 hours since Becky Harper called 911. He handed the baby to a KBI agent who rushed her to the hospital. With the cooperation of every police jurisdiction, a congressman, and a sheriff who was determined to find this baby alive, they succeeded. Baby Stinnett had a small cut on her eyelid and one on her cheek that she could have done with her own small nail. She also had a bruise on the back of her right hand, but she otherwise seemed all right. She was taken to a hospital in Topeka, Kansas for evaluation and DNA testing. Zeb rushed to the hospital, where he was told his daughter was healthy and in good shape. He named her Victoria Joe, as Bobby Joe had wished, and called her his miracle. She was kept in the hospital for 5 more days for observation. Victoria Joe was released from the hospital one day after her mother's funeral. Bobby Joe Stinnett was buried at the Hillcrest Cemetery in Skidmore. Her funeral had been held at the Price Funeral Home Chapel in Maryville, where the press swarmed the mourners. I'm going to pause here for a word from our sponsors. AMC Network's premium streaming video service called Shudder is designed exclusively for fans of horror and thrillers. Known as the Netflix of horror, Shudder has the largest, fastest-growing, human-curated selection of thrilling and dangerous entertainment. And it's on most streaming services in the U.S., Canada, the U.K., Ireland, and Germany. For $5.99 a month or $56.99 a year, you'll have access to the best thrillers, horror, and suspense on any of your favorite devices. You can access Shudder on your iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, Amazon Fire TV, Google Chromecast, Roku, Android devices, and your Xbox One. You'll have unlimited access to stream ad-free Shudder's unique collection of exclusive original films, series, horror classics, and blockbuster hits. Shudder adds new shocking horrors, spine-tingling thrillers, and edge-of-your-seat suspense every week. I love Shudder. I can always find a golden oldie from their Slashix collection, like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, or jump into a newer movie that's exclusively on Shudder, like Lizzie, based on the true story of Lizzie Borden. To try Shudder for free for 30 days, go to Shudder.com and use promo code SouthernFried. That's SHUDDER.com, and then use my promo code SouthernFried. Get started streaming the best horror, thriller, and supernatural content today with exclusive and originally produced series like Creepshow. Settle in for your next great binge watch. Go to Shudder.com and enter promo code SouthernFried. Getting in shape isn't always about fitting into your favorite jeans. It's about building healthier habits that you can stick to. It's also about practicing self-care so you can feel better about yourself, which is really personal. That's why Noom is so great. It's a program that adjusts to your lifestyle. Noom teaches you the psychology behind the decisions you make and helps you keep track of everything, from workouts to logging your meals. Noom has one of the largest and most accurate food databases available, so you can track your meal habits, visualize portion sizes, and check calories at a glance. Noom is not a diet. It's a habit-changing solution that helps you develop a new relationship with food through personalized courses. Noom has given me the ability to make healthy choices more easily, taking the anxiety out of meal planning. And I love the ease of using the Noom app. It's just 10 minutes out of my day to help me keep track of what I eat, find new recipes, and connect with the Noom community. Aside from a personal goal specialist, there's a whole community of Noomers cheering you on, all in the palm of your hand. You don't have to change all in one day. Small steps make big progress. Sign up for your free trial today at Noom, Noom.com/Southern Fried. What do you have to lose? Visit Noom.com/Southern Fried to start your trial today. Again, that's Noom.com/Southern Fried. As police question the couple, a bewildered Kevin Montgomery kept insisting this was all a big mistake. Lisa Montgomery told investigators she had given birth at the Birth and Women's Center in Topeka on the 16th. They called this clinic and there had been no births that day. Kevin said he got home from work on the 16th at about 5:15 p.m. and got a call from his wife. She said she had gone into labor, went to the clinic, and had already delivered the baby. She asked her husband to meet her outside of a Long John Silver's restaurant across the street from the birthing clinic. My research assistant Haley pointed out that first of all, saying she gave birth at that clinic was really smart. It wasn't like a hospital. They had alternative birth methods, like water delivery, and you could be released within hours if there were no problems. And Lisa chose the Long John Silver restaurant right across from the clinic. She really did her homework. Investigator Randy Strong had gone back inside after he handed off the baby to the KBI agent to continue the interrogation. He asked Lisa to step outside. Lisa was advised of her Miranda rights, and then Strong confronted her about the birthing clinic. There had been no baby born there on the 16th. He told her she was lying. She then claimed that they couldn't afford the clinic, and so she had two friends help her. Strong asked her for their names, and then Lisa said, well, they weren't actually in the house, just available by phone. She said she gave birth in the kitchen and threw the placenta in a nearby creek. So then Strong asked her, why did she lie to her husband? Lisa then asked if they could go to the sheriff's office to finish the questioning. And when they got there, she confessed. Lisa said she knew Bobby Joe was pregnant because she saw photos on Bobby Joe's website. Lisa said she strangled Bobby Joe and then used a kitchen knife to cut her belly open laterally, remove the baby, and cut the umbilical cord. She also confessed that she lied to her husband about giving birth to the girl. Kevin evidently was as clueless as he seemed. He told police he didn't think it was weird that Lisa called him to pick her up in the Long John Silver's parking lot. He said, quote, I knew she didn't like hospitals and doctors. He also admitted that another family member had told him Lisa had her tubes tied, but he didn't know what that meant. Let me back up some and go into Lisa's background. She may have appeared harmless and sweet to those who didn't really know her, but many people in her life knew the real Lisa. She was born Lisa Marie Hedberg in Washington State on February 27, 1968. Her parents were Judy and John. Her younger sister Patty was born in 1970. Her mother told Diane Fanning that she was a smart little girl who read a lot, but she liked to tell tall tales. When her parents separated, she told everyone her father had died in Vietnam. Judy soon met a single father named Jack Kleiner. He had five kids. Desperate and in poverty, Judy clung on to him quickly and moved with him to Oklahoma. There she had three more babies, all boys, Teddy in 1974, Jerry in 1975, and Tommy in 1978. Judy characterized Lisa as a habitual liar who almost seemed to have two personalities. Author Diane Fanning spoke with other family members and friends who blamed Judy for Lisa's character. Judy is described as mercurial in temperament and emotionally distant. She didn't provide the love and security her children needed, though ironically, she kept having kids. In February of 1983, Judy claimed that she came home and found Lisa and her stepfather having sex. Lisa was 15 at this time, so this was rape no matter how this woman tried to frame it. Lisa had actually been sexually and physically abused by Jack since she was 12 years old. Judy didn't call the police right away. She claimed Jack had threatened her life if she told about the sexual abuse Lisa suffered, so she stayed quiet. But she did finally call a lawyer for a divorce, though the couple did not divorce until Lisa was 16. Later, Lisa's siblings and step-siblings all testified at trial to the abuse Lisa and they had suffered from Jack Kleiner. He was an alcoholic who beat all of his children, natural or stepkids. The beatings they described were vicious: belts, telephone receivers, and his fists. There is no indication in court documents or elsewhere that Jack beat his wife, but plenty of people said she turned a blind eye to the abuse her children suffered. By the summer of 1984, she was a single mother again, now with five kids. She married a man named Richard Bowman. He had children, but they were all grown. His son Carl was in the Navy and returned home in 1986. He was immediately interested in the now 18-year-old Lisa. She married her stepbrother Carl in August of 1986 and had her first child in January of 1987. A girl named Desiree was followed in quick succession by three more kids: Chelsea in 1988, Carl Jr. in 1989, and Kayla in 1990. Kayla was born 2 months premature, and her doctor recommended a tubal ligation. Lisa later said that her mother and Carl forced her to have her tubes tied. Carl divorced Lisa in 1993. He was tired of her lies. He was tired of working long hours to support so many children. Lisa was supposed to take care of the house and the kids, but it was always filthy, with roaches crawling all over. She ignored her children, preferring to lie on the couch reading books. Carl moved to Springdale, Arkansas, leaving Lisa and his children behind, but she soon followed him there. Even though Carl knew she had her tubes tied, Lisa told him that she was pregnant. He knew that sometimes the procedure wasn't always foolproof, and Lisa had certainly proven to be fertile before. So the couple joined a church, went to counseling, and remarried in June of 1994. And all of a sudden, Lisa was no longer pregnant. Later, in 1994, Lisa claimed she was pregnant with twins. By now, Carl knew she was lying. And while she now had a hobby of raising chickens and goats, she still wasn't taking care of her children. Teachers at their school often cleaned them up and brought them clean clothes to wear at school. Finally, in 1998, Carl moved with all four kids to Oklahoma. Lisa filed for divorce that June. They got joint custody in the divorce, but the judge granted physical custody to Lisa and visitation to Carl. After their divorce, she took the kids and moved to Kansas to live with her mother, Judy. Judy had yet another new husband, and they lived on a farm outside of the small town of Linden. Lisa met Kevin Montgomery in Topeka, Kansas in 1999. He was from the small town of Malvern, about a 12-minute drive from Linden. Kevin came from a good family. They were active in the community and their church. Kevin, already a father, was family-oriented. And yet in 1999, when Lisa lied again and said she was pregnant, he gave her money for an abortion. He wasn't ready to marry her yet. He had just gone through a messy divorce from his first wife, and he had three sons of his own. Their mother had custody, but the boys visited him on the weekends. But Lisa concocted a sad tale about a baby she had when she was a teenager. She claimed her mother told her it was stillborn, but she later found out that Judy had put it up for adoption. No one has ever been able to verify this lie of Lisa's. Judy outright denied it. But Kevin believed her. He felt sorry for her, and he married her in the year 2000. They moved to a small farmhouse outside of Malvern with Lisa's four kids. It was very overcrowded for a family of six, and even worse on the weekends when Kevin's three sons visited. Lisa again threw herself into farm life, raising chickens and hogs and Angora goats, and it was around this time that Lisa became addicted to the internet. She posted about her kids and the future kids she wanted with Kevin. Her oldest children had started high school, and she wanted more babies. In 2002, Lisa said she was pregnant. She told Kevin she was going to the doctor for prenatal care, but she didn't let him go to the appointments with her. When her due date passed, Lisa told Kevin that the baby died, and she had donated its body to science. She faked many pregnancies during this marriage, always claiming that she had miscarried. Kevin evidently believed her, even though her family members were warning him that she lied and had her tubes tied years before. Kevin seems very naive, but maybe he just simply loved Lisa and wanted to believe her. And she was showing him forged documents from doctors and had pulled a sonogram off of the internet to show him. In 2002, Lisa also began breeding rat terriers. In April of 2004, she actually met Bobby Joe Stennett at a dog show. Bobby Joe often posted photos of herself and her dogs to her website, Happy Haven Rat Terriers. She announced her pregnancy on the website not long after that April dog show. And not long after that, Lisa told Kevin she was pregnant again, and due in December. During the fall of 2004, Carl Bowman did fall for custody of his children. He knew that Lisa was still lying about pregnancies. He and his new wife sent her many threatening emails telling her they planned to expose her and use it against her in court. Lisa evidently said she would prove them wrong. She was wearing maternity clothes, and Kevin and most of her friends believed her. But some didn't. Even her pastor was wary. He remarked that she seemed kind of small to be having a baby that soon. But Lisa said, quote, I've always had small babies. And the pastor let it go. In December 2004, Lisa set up a fake online profile and joined the rat terrier community under the name Darlene Fisher. She said she lived in Fairfax, Missouri. Fairfax is around 25 minutes away from Skidmore. On December 15th, this Darlene contacted Bobby Joe on that internet chat room, Ratter Chatter. Darlene said she wanted to look at Bobby Joe's litter of rat terriers. They agreed to meet at Bobby Joe's house the next morning. On the evening of the 15th, Bobby Joe told her husband and her mom that a woman from Fairfax was going to stop by and look at the puppies in the morning. Zeb would be at work. On the morning of December 16th, Lisa traveled nearly 3 hours from Malvern, Kansas, to Bobby Joe's house in Skidmore, Missouri. As I explained above, after Bobby Joe got off the phone with her mother, Lisa attacked her, strangling her from behind with a cord she had brought with her. After she murdered Bobby Joe and took the baby, she drove a short distance from the house and clamped the umbilical cord and suctioned mucus from the baby's mouth. She cleaned up the baby with wipes, drove 2 hours to Topeka, and then called her husband to report the birth. He came and picked her up. They visited their pastor and stopped at a small restaurant called the Whistle Stop Cafe, all supposedly on the day Lisa had given birth. By the time she got home that evening, she had posted a photo of Victoria Jo online and in emails to friends and said she had named her baby girl Abigail. It was about 7 hours later that Maryville, Missouri officers were banging on her door. On January 12, 2005, Lisa was charged in federal court with kidnapping resulting in death. Kevin maintained his ignorance, insisting he believed his wife. Because she crossed state lines with baby Victoria Jo, it was a federal case. Investigators spoke with Lisa's ex-husband, Carl. Carl said he had been planning to take Lisa to court and present the pregnancy lies as the reason why he should have custody of their children. He and his wife had been sending emails to Lisa to let her know they were going to expose her. On December 10th, Carl filed for custody of the two children that lived with Lisa. The custody hearing was set for January 2005. Carl said that in November of 2004, he noticed that Lisa seemed more confident. She called him on December 15th and said she was going to prove him wrong. Investigators now saw a clear motive. In November 2005, it was announced that Lisa would face the death penalty, and her attorneys planned an insanity defense. Her defense team had her evaluated by two different doctors. Both of them diagnosed Lisa with depression, borderline personality disorder, PTSD, and pseudocyesis. The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders defines pseudocyesis as a false belief of being pregnant with objective signs of pregnancy, which may include abdominal enlargement, breast engorgement, reduced menstrual flow, a false sensation of fetal movement, and even labor pains on the supposed due date. And while Lisa had remained small during her fake pregnancy, she did often show off a hard, small belly, encouraging Kevin and her friends to feel the baby kick. However, the federal prosecutor's doctor disagreed. Dr. Park Dietz said she did indeed have depression and borderline personality disorder, but he disputed that she suffered from pseudocyesis. Dietz had testified in other high-profile cases where a defendant's sanity was in question, including Jeffrey Dahmer, the Unabomber Ted Kaczynski, and John Hinckley Jr., the man who had tried to assassinate President Ronald Reagan. He was a respected and well-known professional in the field. The federal prosecutors came well prepared. Lisa's trial began on October 4, 2007, in the Western District of Missouri. Federal prosecutors said that Lisa planned the abduction, and she had searched the internet about how to perform C-sections and home births. The prosecution said Lisa was not insane at the time of the killing. Instead, Lisa was worried that her ex-husband, Carl, was going to expose her lies about being pregnant. The defense did not deny that Lisa killed Bobby Joe. Instead, their defense was that Lisa was mentally ill at the time of the murder, that she suffered from PTSD and pseudocyesis. They claimed Lisa's mental illness and a custody battle with her former husband caused her to kill Bobby Joe. The defense put on the two experts they had hired to explain pseudocyesis. One doctor claimed that Lisa was in a dissociative state, similar to sleepwalking when she killed Bobby Joe. The defense doctor said Lisa's PTSD from childhood sexual abuse predisposed her to pseudocyesis. To sustain her pregnancy delusion, Lisa looked up C-sections, home birth, and hormones to assist in delivery. One psychiatrist pointed out that she had gained 25 pounds during the fake pregnancy and experienced morning sickness. Dr. Park Dietz was called to the stand to refute the testimony of doctors and psychiatrists hired by the defense. He said that there was enough evidence to prove that Lisa knew she wasn't pregnant. He insisted she did not have pseudocyesis. He gave examples. Lisa knew she had her tubes tied and couldn't have any more children. And with her actual pregnancies, she had always gotten prenatal care and her husband went to doctor's appointments with her. And she had always given birth at a hospital. This time, Lisa didn't get prenatal care. She forged documents and had a fake sonogram. She refused to allow her husband to accompany her to the doctor. And she claimed to give birth at a small clinic instead of a hospital. He said to top it all off, in September of 2004, as Lisa was telling her husband and friends that she was pregnant, she filled out a life insurance application and indicated that she was not currently pregnant. Dr. Dietz said anyone having actual delusions of being pregnant wouldn't have manufactured proof showing that they are pregnant. He gave the following example, quote, "Someone having delusions of aliens planting transmitters in their home may destroy their home looking for the transmitters, but they wouldn't go to Radio Shack to buy one and plant in their home to prove the delusion." If Lisa was delusional, she would have told the same story over and over, and no one would have been able to talk her out of it. But Lisa constantly changed her stories. How many times she'd been pregnant in the previous years, how and where she gave birth to baby Abigail, and how she had murdered Bobby Joe. Kevin's ex-wife, Lori, testified that Kevin had, quote, "poor social skills and is easily manipulated," explaining why he didn't see through Lisa's deception. Zeb testified that after finding out Bobby Joe had died and their baby had been abducted, he broke down. When he got the baby back, he moved in with his mother and didn't return to his house until April of 2005. He said that Bobby Joe's death had devastated his life. The jury deliberated for 4 hours before they found Lisa guilty of kidnapping, resulting in death. For the penalty phase, Lisa's defense asked the jury to give her life in prison without parole because of the physical and sexual abuse she suffered as a child. The prosecution said that Lisa was faking mental illness to help get a lesser sentence. They also said that very few people who are sexually abused go on to kill. On October 26th, 2007, after deliberating for more than 5 hours, the jury found that Lisa should receive the death penalty. On April 4th, 2008, Lisa was officially sentenced to death. Bobby Joe's mom, Becky, said, quote, "The case has finally come to a close, but we will never stop missing Bobby Joe. She was a sweet and loving wife, daughter, sister, and would have been a wonderful mother. Our priority now is Victoria Joe. We want her life to be as normal as possible." Lisa appealed her conviction and sentence to the United States of Appeals, and it was denied on all grounds in 2011. All other appeals have also been denied. At the time of the trial, Kevin was still married to Lisa. He even wore his wedding ring on the stand. There are 53 women on death row in the United States. Lisa is the only woman on federal death row. As of today, she is not on the list of 2020 scheduled executions. At the time she was sentenced, Lisa was the third woman to get the federal death penalty. But the other two women have since had their sentences changed to life in prison. According to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, there have been 20 fetal abduction cases going back to 1974. Though I've also seen a study from a professor in Indiana who said the number is really closer to 30. So it is extremely rare. The NCMEC said that the typical offender ranges in age from 12 to 53 and is frequently overweight. The offender often indicates that she has lost a baby or is incapable of having one and is usually married or living with a boyfriend. She typically lives in the same community as her victim and plans the abduction, but doesn't always target a specific victim. Sometimes she just seizes the opportunity. And the baby's race or skin color almost always matches the offender. The husband or significant other rarely has any participation in the planning or execution of the abduction. They are often very gullible. They want to believe their significant other really gave birth or adopted the child. Or they want out of the relationship, and the offender fakes a pregnancy and plans the abduction, hoping to get them to stay. I had an interesting discussion with my research assistant, Haley. She always asks me what I think about a murderer, and she asked if I thought Lisa was insane. I said that by legal definition, no. You must be able to prove a defendant does not know right from wrong at the moment of the murder. They must be in some sort of psychotic episode, unable to tell fantasy from reality. With Lisa's level of deception and careful planning, She definitely does not fit the legal definition. And Lisa went even further than most women do. She stalked a woman from another state for months, much less riskier than someone in her own community. And she had a reasonable story ready for her husband. But I also told Haley that I do believe Lisa is mentally ill. And sadly, in this country, insanity is only black and white. It would take a complete overhaul of our justice system if we wanted to decide on degrees of insanity, the way we do with murder. This is why an insanity defense so often fails. Prisons are full of schizophrenics and other people with different forms of mental illnesses, but you must be legally insane within the moment. If you remember my Mrs. Robinson episode, number 79, her murderer was not deemed sane enough to stand trial initially, but once he was medicated and fit for trial, he was found guilty of her murder. There was also a distinct level of planning in his crime. He was even released on parole, only to have it revoked after he went off his meds and became violent again. He is schizophrenic and is still in prison to this day. Our courts are only concerned with legal insanity, not medical insanity. Lisa Montgomery was sexually abused and beaten as a child and teenager. She was neglected by her mother, and yet later in life, it's like she was emulating her mother, having so many children, one after the other. If you think about it, her mother Judy had 5 children, and Lisa had 4. She may have even felt competitive. Her mother helped her husband force Lisa to have a tubal ligation. Lisa hadn't wanted the operation. She wanted more babies. Her mother, by example, had baby after baby without really caring for them. Lisa was the same way with her own children. She seemed to have this set notion of this is what women do. And Lisa was obsessed with being pregnant. Whether it was to hold on to a man in her life, like with her first husband, or because she just enjoyed the attention, I think that's the case with her second husband. Together, they already had 7 children. She liked the attention pregnancy and new babies brought her. And I bet she looked at the photos of Bobby Joe online with jealousy. She coveted what the happy young mother-to-be had. A normal life. A new pregnancy. A new beginning. Lisa had never been normal. But she knew what it looked like. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Thank you to Haley Gray for her diligent research assistance in this case, and to author Diane Fanning for her book, Baby Be Mine, which provided insight into the other deaths in Skidmore, as well as the investigation of Bobby Joe's murder and Victoria Joe's abduction. I also highly recommend the documentary No One Saw a Thing About Skidmore. It's playing on AMC's Sundance Now. Please remember to practice social distancing, wash your hands, and think of your friends, family, and neighbors. We all need to do our part to protect the most vulnerable in our society. I hope you are all taking care of yourselves and your families during this scary time. And if you're able to, donate to those less fortunate, check with your local charities, or even just check on elderly neighbors. I've got a link to the World Health Organization in today's show notes as well. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I'm sorry, but I no longer answer private messages on social media. I manage 3 platforms, and it's just too overwhelming. But please, feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Wash your hands, and y'all take care.